Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. At this time, John, Dick, Hal, and Paul, we begin the tech vet. This is the meeting of the guys who have got more than average interest in the technology of ham radio. How does all this stuff work? How to make it work better? By way of the very large amount of brain power that's in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. We've got guys that will sign in and can give you answers on almost everything. How does that antenna really work? How does that transmission line really work? How does propagation work? There are 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. So if for some reason the hobby doesn't please you, make sure you try one of the 25, or some number of you of the 25 before you give up. Let me drop. I'm convinced that there's no more educational hobby than this one. I challenge you to find one that will give you a faster amount of education in an area that is poorly covered in the textbooks, very poorly covered in the technical schools. The way you teach wireless engineering is to have a guy with enough enthusiasm work for the right company, become a ham radio operator. He's doing one or another kind of apprenticeship. That's the way you learn it. The schools do not teach it in a useful engineering form. They're stuck in the paradigm for the last 40 years, and they haven't changed. The way we teach RF, the way you start off with the fields and waves course, so to speak, is such that you take any good electrical engineering student graduating with a bachelor or master's degree, you ask him which course did he like the least. Roughly half of them will say that particular fields and wave course is the one that gave them a lot of trouble. Gave them a lot of information that was not in useful engineering form. My goodness, is there room for improvement on that one. By way of ham radio and guys telling each other, I tried such and such antenna, I got this performance, I made this change, and it got that much better. And I talked to people at this range. And whether that range is on the 20-meter ham band, or the 10,000 mega ham band, or the 243 gigahertz ham band. It's the hams that are doing an awful lot of it. The first cell phones were really ham radio operations, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. Okay, enough advertising about ham radio. What the TechNet does is to gather people who sign in because they do have a question or a comment. You've not signed in just because you're listening. The odometer has just flipped over. This is TechNet number 1,500 of the series that began in September of 1942. Here we go, 1982. And so, if you do have a question or a comment, and if you're one of the guys that's not going to be listening to the space program that's on at 9 o'clock on Channel 5, Cosmos, well, pick up between now and 9 o'clock to discuss all these things. You're going to sign in, give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. That's the what we do for the first hour or so. That's followed on our menu by John going to the mailbag for people who don't yet have a ham license or don't have the right equipment to talk to us live. Let me drop. And that's followed by Paul, WS2N, giving us the space report. And all along that process, we also hear from Hal from time to time, K6DPZ, who has touched more ham radio than most of us have even seen. Go to his particular website and look at just the stuff he's got in his stock room. So he quite often will give us his impression of various brand names, various repair procedures, and so on. A lot of experience there. Okay, at this time we're going to take our check-ins. Please give me your call letters and name if you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW TechNet, we're listening.
Dick, this is K2KND. I just wanted to take a minute to congratulate you on 1,500 sessions of the TechNet, which is the equivalent of 6,000 hours, 250 days, 24/7, and congratulations, it's quite a record.
Whoa, thanks.
Well, Mike, the power button to make a feedback.
Joe will recognize, but Rich, thank you very much. Guys, as I've told you guys a couple times in the past, the total number of hours of the TechNet in 30 years, 31 and a half years, is greater than the total number of hours that Johnny Carson has spent on the Tonight Show. So for challenging those kind of records. We believe this is one of the longest running nets of ham radio gathering people, one of the longest running ones under the same, essentially the same leadership. So 31 and a fraction years, 1,500 of them already. Joe, go right ahead with your announcement. W2, Baker Mike Papa, K2RAW.
First, I wanted to extend my congratulations as well. Second of all, I just want to let everybody know that out of 17 people taking the general exam after our class, 17 people passed. And I just wanted to remind everybody that we're offering the extra class starting on Tuesday. It's web-based and instructor-led. If anybody has interest, please email me, whiskey2bravomikepapa@lymark.org. Congratulations again.
Yeah, that's a darn good record, Joe. 17 out of 17. You guys are doing something right. So the extra class will begin on Tuesday. And for those who might not know, where will the extra class be meeting on Tuesday, Joe? Go ahead, Joe.
Well, the beauty of it is that you take class right on your computer, any tablet, any smartphone. You can take it while you're on the Long Island Railroad. Again, it's web-based, so it's internet-based, but it's instructor-led by me. And just shoot me an email, and we'll get you registered for the class.
Okay, so a person automatically signs up for that, if I understand it correctly, Joe, by going to w2bmp@lymark.org, telling them who you are and that you're interested in the extra class. And after that, it's all automatic. You give them a URL that they sign into by which they are then getting this a live instruction, so to speak. Is that roughly the way it works, Joe? W2BMP, K2RAW.
Yep, that's exactly the way it works. It's a GoToMeeting URL, and I'll be waiting there for you. And our students love it, and we have an absolutely spotless record, 100% on both technical and 100% on the general so far.
So the technician and general, good track record, and extra coming up. And I believe the so-called advanced license no longer exists, or the conditional might not any longer exist. Well done, Joe. Okay, for those who do have a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, TechNet listening.
AC2WGB with a quick statement.
There's Gabe and yes.
AC2MDP, Steve and yes.
A6DPZ with quick answers.
Okay, I heard John. Okay, well, we had some doubles and triples. I heard John first, followed by Gabe, followed by Steve. Gabe, I didn't get your call letters here. Give me your call letters, Gabe.
Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Alpha Romeo.
Okay, John, Gabe, and Steve in that order. Who is the next person signing in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N4 with the space report. Good evening, Dick, John, and Hal.
And I hope you saw 60 Minutes tonight, Paul. Beautiful demonstration of what SpaceX is doing, both in rocketry and in automobiles. So I guarantee you'll be giving us some information about that. John, I know you've got announcements. Go right ahead. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everybody on the net. I just want to let you know that I'm raising a pennant for the Bravo Zulu for you of 1,500 sessions, which I think is a light number, but just keep up the good work. Getting a lot of nice emails tonight. So do well and enjoy. Back to you, Dick.
Thanks, you have to book.
Now, what's recognized? Freddie, we heard from you. And you being a Navy man from way back, John, give us a couple of sentences as to what Bravo Zulu in the Navy jargon means. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Well done, good job, and congrats, basically.
JF on frequency.
Okay, I heard something, JF. Are you signing in, Mr. JF? Give us the full call and your name, sir.
Show here in Bayshore, WA2PJF, with a question.
Very fine, Tito. Tito, one of our more substantial members, and we're looking forward to talking to you. I've got more than enough to get going. Hey, Gabe, we'll discuss anything except antennas tonight. What would you like to talk about? Having some fun with you. KP2MAR, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KTRW, this is KP2MAR. Hey, I have a question regarding a Kenwood Land Mobile radio. It is a model Tango Kilowatt 715. I believe that this particular transceiver was supposed to be used with UPS set up many years ago. And you know what happened with that? They stopped the whole thing just stopped completely. And I purchased this radio at Mendelssohn, the Hamvention, a couple of years ago. I'm just curious, what type of frequency does this radio transmit on? 220, I believe it is 220, because UPS did want to use a 220 portion of the band. On the next transmission, I'll tell you some features this radio has. KP2MAR, back to net.
Yeah, when it comes to people who've got a lot of experience with a lot of easy pieces of equipment, Hal?
I can give you an answer.
Okay, we're going to go to Hal first and then Eric in that order. Hal, have you ever heard of the Tango Kilo 715 Kenwood K60PZ, K2RIW in the TechNet?
715 was a VHF radio, if I remember correctly, but UPS was going to use 220 as their one of their frequencies, you know, early part of the 220 band. Without pulling a manual on, I can't say any more, Dick. Go ahead.
Pretty fine, Hal. Sounds like Eric has had some experience with them. I wonder if they were used in the broadcast industry. KE2EJ, K2RIW, tell us about that mysterious rig, Eric.
Yeah, those radios and a couple of other manufacturers. There's an ACSSD. There's a single sideband radio with a pilot tone to keep it on frequency. And that gave them a very narrow bandwidth. So it's not an FM radio, if you would think of it that way. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, you sound good, Eric, but you could use a tiny bit more audio. I think you called it ACSSB. I know that there were proposals at one time for a kind of narrowband or single sideband FM was something that was proposed. I remember there was a fairly extensive technical article in Ham Radio Magazine on that subject way back in the dark ages. So expand that acronym a little bit more and tell us what it was supposed to do from your memory. KE2EJ, K2RIW, right, Eric?
Gabe would like to know what he can do with it, what it's capable of.
All right, it was adaptive single sideband, and a number of different manufacturers made them. It was essentially single sideband with a pilot, and the pilot was used to keep the frequency of it exactly right. As you typically tune on a sideband radio, you have to tune up and down to get it in the right spot for you to hear it without with the audio being correct. Basically, it was a companded algorithm that worked with it. The pilot tone kept it exactly spot on, and it was quite narrow, and it used a part of the 220 band that we lost. And it was in use for a little while, but it kind of faded away. So, that's the story. You can look it up. That type of modulation is well known. K2RIW, K2J. And what can you use it for? You can use it as a sideband radio.
Yeah, if I took my ordinary single sideband radio, open up the case, reach in there, and adjust the doubly balanced mixer balancing control so that I knock it a little bit out of balance, which in the case of using a doubly balanced mixer as a sideband modulator, you're really injecting a small amount of DC voltage or current into the IF port of the doubly balanced mixer, and it will allow you to have some of the carrier fed through. And so under normal circumstances, a little bit of carrier feed, so it doesn't annoy anybody. It's a victimless crime, so to speak. So do you have reason to believe get it into the ham radio portion of 220 band, it would have reasonably normal sounding single sideband, where it is companded. I'm a little worried about that. Usually the companding technique is to compress the audio on transmission and then expand it on reception, which requires special reception capability, and it wouldn't be ordinary sounding single sideband. So give me some guesses, Eric, as to how much use do you think Gabe will be able to make? Do you think he's going to have to make a significant number of modifications? Or do you think he can almost use it as is once he gets it on the right frequency? KE2EJ, the pro of this particular wild piece of equipment, K2LIW. You got it, Eric. Also, Eric, how in the world did you come across this thing? You got it, Eric.
Well, it just so happened that we took apart a whole bunch of those radios that were being removed, and I played with some of them before we took the pieces out and used them for other stuff. It kind of sounds almost like what you hear on your sideband radio. It's just a little, you get a little bit of carrier leak through, so you hear a little bit of the pilot tone. The receivers that they use, it actually filters it out. You can, in essence, use it as a sideband radio. It's intelligible, but the audio characteristics are not, it's companded. You can hear it. So, but the RF amplifier section of it is fine. The synthesizer section of it is fine. There's a lot of stuff you could do with it. I mean, you could actually rip the modulator out and put in, your own version of FM modulator, put a varactor on the VCO and feed the audio, and a lot of different things you can do. The receiver is usually pretty good, but to turn the receiver into FM, you'd have to take another phase lock loop and stick that at the rear end of it and extract the audio from that. So if you're into building a little bit of stuff, you can turn it into a pretty decent radio.
I'm getting a nice long delay in case anyone else wants to sign in from the outer areas by Echo Link or IRLP. In an ordinary single sideband transmitter where the carrier balance is not ideal and a little bit of carrier feeds through, and if you align your receiver correctly, that carrier turns out to be a zero beat and you don't hear it. And so under normal circumstances, if the carrier was the pilot tone with a properly set sideband receiver, it wouldn't be there. However, you did make it sound like you would hear that tone. I wonder if the pilot tone was some other frequency other than the zero beat carrier frequency, if you know what I mean, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Now, if you had the proper receiver with the expander on it, you wouldn't hear it. I'm talking about, if you tune it in so that the audio really sounds pretty decent, you're actually tuning it slightly off the frequency that it's supposed to be on. But the pilot is actually, a little bit of carrier that's intentionally injecting there.
Very good information, Eric. All of us as ham radio operators have thousands of times in our life heard a single sideband signal being received. And any one of us could walk into a room, hear the audio, and say immediately, that's a sideband signal. It's got a very distinctive sound compared to FM. Almost 99% of the time we'll know it. Because the guy who sets the receiver is habitually setting it a little bit high in pitch, and as such, the individual harmonic frequencies turn out to be dissonant, and human voice sounds a little bit crazy. One of the things you don't know, a lot of people don't know, is that all of those long-distance phone calls of the past 50 years really were single-sideband audio. However, those are groups and master groups and super groups by which the individual tone pieces of information, individual telephone conversations were going on, all had a pilot tone that allowed the so-called receiver to be set perfectly. A sideband receiver that's set with a phase lock loop on the carrier, so that there is no offset in the tuning of the frequency of the receiver, can, in theory, give you the most high fidelity audio in the world, and you'll never know it's sideband. So I see a potential advantage for this. If we amateurs insisted on having a small amount of carrier always being fed out of the single sideband transmitter, and then in turn, our receiver had the right kind of a phase lock loop that were locked onto that carrier, that would automatically force the sideband receiver to be tuned perfectly so that there's no tonal shift, and therefore you'd be hearing essentially high fidelity audio. You and I could insist on that if you wanted to, and maybe that's a possible goal for a possible way of using this thing, Gabe. KB2, MAR, I think you got a goodie there. K2RIW on the TechNet.
By the way, Dick, the ones that I played with were made by Glenn Air.
Glad to hear that. Go ahead, Gabe. Out of curiosity, Gabe, was yours made by Glenn Air? I think you said it was, Kenwood. You've got it, Gabe.
QSL, Dick, it's a Kenwood made in France. And by the way, I'm going to read you some of the buttons that this rig has in front of it. I can give you a little bit of a description of each one. Okay, there's a call key. Press to place a call to another party.
There's a clear key.
Press to end the call.
There's an event selector.
Turn to select various information that will appear on the display.
Such as the identification IRN number of a
party you want to call.
An SP key.
Press to select the status, diversion, or stack mode.
Vivid key.
While in numeric mode, press to select the tens or hundreds digit. Then turn the ident selector to select the ident number of the party you want to call.
The function key. Press to select the
directory, numeric, or telephone mode.
Also press the end of status,
diversion, or stack mode.
Back to net.
My goodness, Gabe, that is quite a rig. By the way, as you were walking away from the microphone, so to speak, in order to read the buttons on the front panel, you were either talking into the side of your microphone or your finger was going over the tiny little hole where the electret microphone is located. So every so often on that last transmission, your audio became quite muffled. So sometimes people will, by mistake, put the finger in the wrong place and get that effect. Somebody want to say something? Okay, that was an interesting description. You've got one hell of a piece of hardware there. As you dig further into it and find out how to use it on the 220 band, keep us informed. Check with us periodically. And out of curiosity, Gabe, are there more of these available? And were they being sold at a fairly nice price? Maybe there's other people who want to join on this deal with you. KB2MAR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
QSL, by the way, I purchased this at Mendelssohn's at Hemvention several years back. And while I was there, I was lucky enough to see a stack of like maybe 50 of them, believe it or not. And they went like hotcakes. Well, I was lucky enough to buy one, and the unit was brand new in the box, full with all the brackets, the wiring harness, everything. And I paid, by the way, it's commercial quality setup. It's not just a little flimsy radio. The microphone, just the microphone alone is worth about $100. And that's how much I paid for the whole thing, was $100, brand new in the box. I don't know where you're going to get, I think you can go on eBay and get these, but I don't know where else. Maybe someone can contact Mendelssohn. They might have some left over. I don't know. KB2MAR, back to net.
Very fine. For those who tuned in late, what you're hearing is a discussion of what Gabe bought at Mendelssohn's, I think a surplus house in New Jersey, a couple of years ago. And it's a Kenwood Tango Kilo 715.
Ohio.
Yeah, Ohio. So Tango Kilo 715 is the rig. It's a single sideband companded transmitter on the 220 band. Anyone else within the sound of my voice who owns one of these or knows somebody who owns one, give me a call. Let us right now. Let's hear about it. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe if the guys that have signed in tonight, you're the only guy that owns one right now, but they're out there. And it's going to take a little bit of smarts to use them the way you want to. But I think it's, as I see it, it's a project worthwhile, Gabe. Keep us informed and good luck with that project. John, I think I forgot you. I know you wanted to make an announcement. Maybe you already did, and I'm so forgetful. KC2WGB, KQRIW.
KC2WGB. No, that was my Bravo Zulu, Dick. No, it's already complete. Thank you.
Very fine, John. Those Navy guys, something else. Steve's the next guy up at bat. And Steve, I'm going to have some fun with you. We'll discuss anything except antennas. KC2MDP, K2LAW. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. Tonight, I don't have a question on antennas, so we're all good. Okay, I'll throw this one out to the net because I don't know how up you are on this. Basically, it's a question about computers and Echolink. Basically, what I'm having it is Echolink, it fails the firewall test. And what happens is I run through it. I run through the, you know, the firewall on the computer. I end up checking that. I checked everything in the router, forward the ports. And what happens is I get the thing to work, and like a week later, the same thing will happen. It'll fail the firewall test. And I have to go through the whole rigmarole of going through the firewall and everything else, seeing if everything has changed or, you know, stuff like that. And to tell you the truth, I'm so confused with it, I don't even know what I actually keep doing to get it to work. So I was wondering if anybody else had that problem, if they had any ideas on what I should look for. Back to you.
I can answer that, too.
Very fine, Eric. Eric, we're going to have to hire you. By the way, if you were hearing John earlier tonight, he was discussing his grief he was getting with a computer. Anybody can make a mistake. To really screw up requires a computer. Anybody can get angry at a piece of equipment. If you really want to get angry, it's got to be a computer. Eric, what do you think Steve ought to do? KE2EJ, KE2LIW in the technet. Take your time, Eric.
Okay. Sounds to me like it didn't really set up its router properly. Right, when you do your port forwarding, wherever your computer is, whatever IP address is being assigned by DHCP, in essence, you don't want it to change, because what you're going to do is you're going to forward the UDP ports. I think it's the 8836, I can look it up, I forget, not on the top of my head. There's a bunch of UDP addresses and a TCP address that you have to forward. And what you want to do is you want to make sure that you're really in your router, that the machine you're using for Echolink always stays at that local IP address, and that those forwarded ports are always associated with that IP address. Some routers, when you shut off your PC and you shut it down, you bring it up again, DHCP gives it another address. And your port forwarded is sitting on a different address. So when you go to try to use it, it doesn't work. Then you've got to go and reassign those port forwards to the current IP address that your computer is at. This is typically what happens to most people. K2IW, K2J.
Okay, yes, Steve, I wonder if that was enough information to give you guidance as to what to do next. If not, you're allowed to ask more questions. You're allowed to come back next week and ask questions. I'm a little worried that this is the problem you're describing is not going to go away in an instant. I don't think there's an easy glamour fix here. KC2MDP, K2LIW, go ahead, Steve.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. Now, what Eric says makes an awful lot of sense, because I did this, I did that, and I did notice that when it does the firewall test, it'll give you the IP address. So I found the IP address, you know, of the local computer I'm running on it, and sure enough, it did change. What I did is, you know, I went into the router, and I put the IP address of the computer into the router for the port forwarding. Sometimes it worked, other times it didn't. Now, that was the thing that threw me off, is I checked, I made sure I had the same IP address in the router as the computer, and it wouldn't work, and then what I did is I went to the firewall. Basically, I didn't change anything. I looked at it, and, you know, magically, all of a sudden, it passed the firewall test, and everything was good, and it'll be like that for about a week or so, and then all of a sudden, I'll go to use it again, and it'll fail the firewall test. Back to you.
Very fine, Steve. I know that some of you guys who listen are a lot smarter about computers than I am, for sure. Anyone else who has any other further suggestions for Steve on getting his computer to be happy with Echolink. Give us your call letters and name right now. If you got anything else, any other hints you want to give to Steve, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'll add something if nobody else has anything to say.
Okay, we'll listen for anybody else, and then we're going to go over to Eric in that order. Anybody else, give us your call letters and name right now. You've got it, Eric.
All right, I don't know what kind of a router you're using, but what you can do is you can go into your router setup, and you can associate the MAC address, which is actually the hardware address of your network card, and associate that MAC address with an IP address so it will never change. Another way to do it is to create a static IP address within your own system locally, and that will never change. What you would do is pick an address that's outside the range of the DHCP that you have set up on the computer. And remember, when you do port forwarding, you're really only going to be able to port forward one machine. So if you have like three or four machines floating around the house and you're trying to set it up for multiple machines, that becomes rather problematic because the last one that you set it up for will be where it is. It won't be the one that you had set up previously, but that's kind of the way most of these home routers are. K2RIW, page again.
Thank you, Eric. Steve, do you need any further fills on all of the above? Ask it right now. KC2MDP, K2RIW.
No, Dick. I greatly appreciate Eric's input, and I think he's pretty much exactly right. So basically what he's saying is the computer has a dynamic IP address, and somehow either through the router or the computer itself, I got to make that IP address static so it doesn't change, and every time it changes, Echolink basically thinks it's an old IP address. Back to you.
Very fine, Steve. Hey, Steve, as time goes on, please come back and tell us what you did, how well it worked, because I guarantee that a lot of other people in your category are trying to enable Echolink or ILLP or any of these other crazy computer modes. To me, any computer mode is crazy. It's not RF. The only real electronics is wireless electronics. These computers are just a flash in the pan. They're never going to go anywhere. Obviously, I'm giving you guys some ironic statements. The next person who signed in was this youngster, Vito, VA2PJF. I'm calling him as a youngster because he's 4 years younger than me. So he's a youngster. The VA2PJF, the microwave voice of Bayshore, K2RIW. Go ahead, Vito.
Hey, Dick. How are you? Everyone on the net? Nothing technical. Just a simple question. Maybe someone listening can help me. I'm looking for someone who services Collins radio equipment here in Suffolk County. I have a pristine 7582 receiver, but it has a few operating issues, and I've fixed a couple myself already, but others need more attention. So maybe somebody here in Suffolk County you would know who can help me with that. Back to net.
Yeah, there are people on this planet who think the only piece of ham radio that was ever built of any quality was the company in, why can't I think of the name of the town in Iowa? It'll come to Fort Collins, Iowa, I think it was. Anyhow, Collins Riggs, there are people out there who just...
Colorado, Riggs.
Okay, Fort Collins, Colorado. There are people who just love that particular rig. So, are the people within the sound of our voice right now, if you know of anyone who likes, enjoys, has experience at fixing Collins equipment, particularly a 7582, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW in the second half. Okay, because it is getting into a commercial area, so to speak, I know that Hal is unable to legally come on and advertise his services. However, I, as a ham radio operator, can express an opinion. My opinion is that Hal has a lot of experience collecting the individual components, collecting zillions of individual Collins transmitters, receivers, and so on. So I know that Hal, K6TPZ, is one of the people who has a lot of experience with Collins. Maybe Hal wants to agree or disagree with me. And as I said, he's not able to advertise his services, but I, the ham radio operator, can tell you, a fellow ham radio operator, he has done quite a few of those. Anybody who wants to give us any further comments, give me a call. Let us right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. Yeah, I think I know that Rich N2EO also is a great Collins collector who collects the names of the people who are into Collins repair and also the names of the websites where Collins components are sold to those that want to do upgrading, repair, and so on. So by way of Rich N2EO, and we eventually get a hold of him again when he's back out of the hospital, and when and if you did call Hal or go to Hal's website, K6DPZ, I think you will eventually find some leads that will give you the path to the repairs that you're looking for. And so your shiny piece of Collins equipment is going to eventually be up to full specification performance, as I see it, Avito. Don't give up. It's worth fighting for. There are people, and as I see it, any money you put into a piece of Collins equipment, I think is money in the bank. There's always somebody out there that will buy it from you at some later time if you want to sell it. WA2PJF, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Richie. In reference to Richard N2EO, he's not coming home anymore. He's in a hospital. He had his leg amputated, and I understand, I've been told that there's some thought to his house being sold, so he will no longer be getting involved with radio equipment. I'm guessing from connections that I have that that know him and know what's happening. That information I just received a few hours ago. Okay, thank you for all you've done for me. I was just looking for somebody close to home. That was the whole idea. Traveling, I'm not a traveling person. I know a guy in Glen Cove does very nice work, but I need an airplane to get to his house. So I'm too old to travel. I'm 70 years old. I feel like 100. God bless. Thank you so much to all out there and all those concerned. WA2PJF is clear.
Yeah, I wouldn't give up so easily on Rich N2EO. Yes, he may be moving, and yes, he's had some medical problems, but still, from those I know who have talked to him, he's still a bright guy. He's got a lot of information in his head as to how to repair Collins equipment, the names of people who do it, the real aficionados, what websites to go to. So when you get Rich on the telephone, guarantee you'll find some further information along these lines, Vito. And good luck with that project, and come back and let us know how it goes. The next person who signed in was Freddie, KB2VBN. And Freddie, let's see how well we're coming to you tonight. KB2VBN, K2RAW in the TechNet.
This is KB2VBN.
KB2VBN, K2RIW. We're hearing you very well with your newer antenna, Freddie. So go right ahead with a question or a comment if you have one. KB2VBN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Freddie.
Okay, Roger, I got an 8-surf radio that I'm going to try to hook up over here. I'm on the ground floor using a magnetic mount antenna. I haven't done HF in a long time. Can anybody hear me on the 10-meter band up in Washington Heights?
I say absolutely yes. I, for one, Freddie, am a strong enthusiast of mag mount antennas. I will admit that all the mag mount antennas I've ever used, one of them was on 6 meters, most of them have been on 2 meters or 440. And to make a mag mount antenna work on HF, a little bit more difficult. And because the whip itself on a HF mobile rig, for instance, usually is pretty darn long, as such, people will connect it to some kind of mechanical structure that's connected to the bumper of the car, for instance, or down to the sheet metal. Very few people are going to use a mag mount on HF. Definitely doable. And the M Squared Company, among others, will sell you a magnetic structure, these three great big round things that are about 5 inches in diameter, really potent magnets that are all attached together to one structure. You put that onto the roof of a sheet metal car, and boy, that thing will hang on. And you could put a, you could definitely put a 2 meter, here we go, you could definitely put a 10 meter or 15 meter whip on that, with the loading coil, of course. Is it doable? Without a doubt. Your main function, as I see it, to get efficiency out of any antenna on any frequency is, number one, it's got to resonate. Let me drop. By one means or another, you're going to make the antenna resonate. You guys have heard me say it's a don many times. You resonate first, then you can radiate. By the word radiate, I mean whether you're transmitting or receiving, I'm calling that radiating. It's got to resonate, and it's got to resonate electronically. If you have the resources to make the antenna mechanically the right length so it's resonant, life is simpler. But it's not a showstopper if you don't have the resources to do that. If your antenna is too short to be a resonant length, then by putting the right kind of a L network, LC coil, which you can design with the Berkeley program, and the Berkeley program and similar pieces of information you can easily get by going to that website, which is now called LimarkTechnet.com. LimarkTechnet.com is a particular website being run by K1MJM. Mike's doing a beautiful job of assembling the kinds of equipment, the kinds of information that we use. And so the Berkeley site for doing impedance matching, whether you're going to use a L network to force your antenna into resonance, or whether you're going to use a wide range antenna tuner, those are your choices, minor functions, if you know what I mean. So once you get the antenna, even if it's too darn short, let me drop. Everyone believes that if the antenna is physically too short, it must have a smaller effective capture area, lower performance, lower gain. Good philosophy, dead wrong. Once you're talking about dipole and monopole-like antennas and smaller versions of them, as long as you've used lossless materials to build the antenna and lossless materials to make your impedance matching network, as long as you've done it losslessly, the antenna loses essentially never more than half a dB of gain as you go down to infinitesimal size in a dipole-like structure. Opposite of common sense. You go to the right chapter of the one of the Bibles of antenna engineering. It's called Krauss's book, McGraw-Hill, 1950, called Antennas. And is now, that was the first edition, and there's two more editions after that. But you go to the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole, and you find out that as long as you force it into resonance, you'll get full performance out of a super small antenna. I will admit, there's one disadvantage. Let me drop. If the radiating structure is physically small compared to, let's say, a half wavelength or a quarter wavelength, if it's physically small, then the antenna will be higher in Q. That's a fancy way of saying it'll be narrower in bandwidth. And so on the 10-meter band, if you QSY by 50 KC, you'll have to do some retuning of the antenna tuner. So it becomes more narrow band. That's the only real disadvantage you suffer when you make the antenna small. So resonate it first. Once you've established resonance, then the only other thing that's between you and high performance is how high up it is. You build that antenna in the bottom of a well, and not very many people are going to hear you. You put it up on a high tree or on the second floor of your apartment building, people are going to hear you. And whether or not your antenna is resonant, you find that out real fast by measuring standing wave ratio. Once you've established a good impedance match and resonance of the antenna, whatever you're using for measuring standing wave ratio, whether it be, let me drop, whether it be an antenna analyzer, whether it be a standing wave ratio bridge, whether it be your Bird watt meter where you measure forward and reverse power, by whatever means, once you force the antenna to be resonant on your operating frequency and reasonably well impedance matched, and your L network designed by that Berkeley program, and I told you how to get to that Berkeley program, just by Googling the word Berkeley and impedance match, you'll find it real fast. Once you've got that information and you properly use it, your antenna is going to fly. You can't stop it from doing that, if you know what I mean. So it's a step-by-step process. And if it doesn't work at first, by measuring standing wave ratio, usually it's the first clue of where you should go from there, if you know what I mean, Freddie. Good luck with that project. KB2VBN, they're going to hear you on 10 meters once you solve this minor problem. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Hey, Roger, sounds good to me. One more thing. And I'll hear a couple of guys saying a dipole antenna. Can you put a dipole antenna against the wall of a building and it will still work if it's flat against the wall?
Absolutely. You can't stop it from working. I will admit that if the wall of your building happens to have a whole lot of sheet metal on it, and if you put the dipole flat against the sheet metal, that would be a very difficult impedance match problem. But if you did impedance match it, it would fly. Almost all buildings have got a brick face, and they've got some metal lathing structure inside. And by the way, the opinions I'm giving you right now, Fred, I'll give you some warning. You get on the 20-meter band on Saturday morning, and you tell people you're going to do this, and they're all going to tell you you're crazy. They've got all kinds of crazy opinions as to the zillions of things that they think will make an antenna stop working. Now, a dipole, a monopole, a long wire hanging outside of your window of your apartment building, hanging off your balcony, laying parallel to the brick face of a building. The brick face of the building and the metal stuff that's inside the building will change the tuning of a dipole a little bit. But you're a smart enough guy that knows how to retune it for that location. So I, for one, have, as a consultant, quite often been forced by my clients to put antennas inside of tiny little boxes, you know, a handheld device where there's nowhere near enough room for a UHF antenna, and you squeeze it in there by wrapping it around and whatever, and it's alongside of the metal of the printed circuit board and alongside of the high-power transistors and the battery and everything else. Let me drop. All of that nearby metal makes the tuning of the antenna a little bit more difficult. You got to do a little further engineering to force it into resonance and force it into a good impedance match. But once that antenna, in that terrible environment, where you would think that, hey, all the radio signal is going to be shorted out and it can't go anywhere. Absolutely not. Once you force that antenna into a good impedance match, good resonance, it will radiate. And once you force that antenna to radiate, that signal goes out into every single cubic inch of this universe, and it's going to go there. You can't stop it from doing that. I'll admit that behind a building, behind a hill, down in a well, the signal is going to be a hell of a lot weaker, but the signal is always there. It never stops. So by the time you radiate 50 watts, we'll say, out of your 10-meter rig into an antenna that you forced into resonance, no matter where that antenna is located, somebody's going to hear you, Freddie. And don't let them talk you out of it. Just go do it. It's like the guys who first studied the bumblebee that came to the conclusion he can't possibly fly. Well, the bumblebee didn't do that. He's flying anyhow. KB2EBN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Roger, that's my next project. I'm going to check out the MFJ dipole I've seen in the magazine for $50. All band dipole.
Yeah, I'm not particularly familiar with that particular antenna. I'm not familiar with any HF antennas. Maybe other people are. And so by checking with them, you'll get some other opinions. It's going to work, Fred. You can't stop it from working. Once you know how to check whether or not it is hitting resonance, because you lay it up against the building and it changes the resonance, and you retune it accordingly, and the retuning might mean just readjusting a wide-range antenna tuner or putting an L network on the antenna, putting a loading coil, a top hat capacitor, zigzagging it a little bit differently in the way you lay it out. There's a zillion ways you can make the antenna resonant. Once it's resonant, you're three-quarters of the way home. After that, a good impedance match with the resonance, and it's going to radiate. You can't stop it from doing that. And people are going to hear you once you radiate. The worst-case situation I know of was what was the name of the thing? Herbie. I can't remember Herbie's call letters. This was a guy 20 years ago, a Limark member, where his landlord would not let him put any antenna on the house that he was renting. Let me drop. Now, this really persnickety landlord would visit his house periodically, and if there was any single piece of wire hanging in the tree or whatever, he was told to immediately take it down. Freddie got around the problem by making the so-called Herbie snake antenna. It really consisted of pieces of RG-8 coaxial cable with breaks in certain places in the shielding, and he laid the RG-8 cable flat onto the lawn, and he let the lawn grow a little bit higher so the grass would hide the cable that's laying down there in the lawn. With this 20-meter antenna made out of coaxial cable laying flat on the lawn, we called it the Herbie snake antenna, he was on 20 meters. And we ran an on-the-air test with Herbie and compared it to somebody who had a real half-wave dipole and 20 meters high in the tree versus the Herbie snake. Herbie was, I'll admit, he was 2.5 S units weaker than anybody else, but he was on the air and he was making contacts. I can't think of any worse environment for a 20-meter antenna than laying flat on the ground of a grassy front yard, if you know what I mean. So, although it hurt the signal strength somewhat because, let me drop, that local dirt underneath that grass is a volumetric resistive lossy material that was sucking up some of the energy, and the worms are getting warm there in the wintertime, and he was transmitting, if you know what I mean. So that was the method of loss, because it was so close to this lossy material called dirt. And I'm guessing that his antenna would tune differently on a rainy day versus a dry day. But with a good antenna tuner, he could accommodate that. So, as you can see, I can't think of any worse environment for an antenna than the bottom of a well, if you know what I mean. So even that worked. And so he was on the air and he was making contacts. So hang in there, Herbie, and let us know how this project goes. KB2VBN for any other finals. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Roger, that was a good move there. He's making doing the snake signal. I'm going to be doing the wall fly signal. This is KB2VBN. Thank you for the information.
Yeah, that was the Herbie snake antenna, and you're going to make the Freddy wallflower antenna. You can even paint it so it's identical to the color of the wall so that the landlord doesn't see it, and good luck. There are guys who have made all kinds of stealthy antennas, Freddy. They've hidden an antenna in the middle of the flagpole. They have hidden it in the gutters and the downspout tubing of the house. There's all kinds of ways that you can make a stealthy antenna, or antenna where the human eye doesn't see it, and yet it's sitting there radiating like a charm. So there's lots of ways of doing it. In fact, there's a guy who published a book on how to make hidden antennas. Okay, I think it's time for the mailbag. And I hope these guys are not going to stump us tonight, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. All right, good evening again to everyone on the net. I don't think these will be difficult. Let's see. I have an antenna question. Let me let it drop and I shall proceed. Okay, we have another tree antenna. This gentleman ran three lengths of RG8U out to a tree, which is about 75 feet from his house. It's about 50 foot tall, and he has three antennas he wants to install on it, 10, 20, and 40 meters. He's going to use some number 12 wire brown, which matches up with the bark pretty well. He says it won't be seen, because he has a problem with the landlord also. He's going to use 3-inch phenolic standoffs to keep it away from the tree, but he's interested in the arrangement. Should the 40-meter go in the center and the 10 and 20 flanking, or also the distance between it, the maximum he can get is 6 inches. He's also questioning on the 40-meter, he wants to know if he would zigzag it in Z, is going up the tree to get a longer length, if that's permissible. And what should he do, and maybe you have some tips for him. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
And let me run by one more time with you, John. Did he say what bands does he want? Is he trying to go through 80 through 10 meters, or only 80, 40, and 20? Did he say what frequency does he want there, John? Go ahead.
10, 40, and 20. And he's hoping he'll be able to tune the 20 to 2 bands, possibly. But basically, he's worried about those three bands, 10, 40, and 20.
And the nice thing about those bands is they're harmonically related. There's even a slim possibility that the one piece of wire could do all of it with the right kind of impedance-matched network. You've got a lot of ways to go. The conventional approach would be a fan dipole, where you feed in the center a dipole that's halfway for 10 meters, another one halfway for 20 meters, halfway for 40 meters, all fed from the center, and the ends are splayed out a little bit, as much as you can get. And you start to ask the question, okay, if I'm spreading them out very short amount because I don't have very much real estate to deal with, can I still make it work? Answer is absolutely yes. Let me drop it. The worst situation I know of is a guy did make a fan dipole where all of the individual dipoles were part of a ribbon cable, a 4 or 6 wire ribbon cable that's used for feeding an antenna rotator. And he was just cutting the individual wires the right length and feeding them all from the center. And there they were very parallel to each other, and let's say an eighth of an inch or so apart. When you put the higher frequency elements very close to the lower frequency elements, you do pick up some extra capacitance and some extra detuning. Therefore, you have to readjust the length accordingly. It's not a showstopper. It just means you've got to do some extra effort. And that extra effort usually is sweeping across the band of interest and measuring the standing wave ratio. If you got the length just right, the standing wave ratio curve on an XY plot, frequency horizontal, standing wave ratio vertical, you sweep your rig to 7.0, 7.1, 7.2, 7.3, and maybe 7.4 megacycles, and you measure the standing wave ratio, or maybe even places in between. And you put those dots on the chart, and you connect them with a nice smooth curve. Good job. You should derive a bathtub-shaped curve, a U-shaped curve, and if the bottom of the U is at your favorite frequency in the band, then you've got the right length. And if the bottom of that curve is too high, you know that your dipole is a little bit too short. If it's too low, you know it's too long. So you can easily take each one of those individual dipoles of the fan dipole and find out which way you've got to move them in order to bring them back into resonance. If you don't want to use a broad bandwidth antenna tuner and electronically bring them back into resonance, the choice is yours. You get a little bit more performance when you do it with the real antenna as opposed to the antenna tuner, because when you're doing it with the antenna tuner, and if the antenna tuner is in the shack with you and you've got a pretty long piece of coax running at a fairly high standing wave ratio, you do pick up some extra loss of that coax. Let me drop. Now, that's a conventional fan dipole fed in the center, strung vertically in your tree, and you got to bring a transmission line up the tree to be feeding the center of the dipole. Although it's rare, and although people don't understand it, the half-wave dipole that you feed from the bottom, the outer edge of the dipole, works equally as well. Gives you the exact same performance, gives you the exact same gain, gives you the exact same efficiency. The only trouble is that now when you feed the outer edge of the dipole instead of the center, where the center is around 70 ohms of impedance, the outer edge is closer to 2,000 ohms. And so Bob, for instance, was having a Bob's W2OSR, one of our directors from Limark. He was having a thread of information back and forth on the internet with a bunch of guys, and Bob was following our advice from the TechNet, talking about the advantages of feeding the outer edge of the dipole. Let me drop. And on this thread of internet information flying back and forth, Bob got quite a bit of flack from guys who says, no, you don't want to do it that way. You don't want to feed the outer edge because you've got to use an L network to step up the impedance from 50 ohms to 2,000 ohms, which is easy as all hell with the Berkeley program. You can easily fabricate that inductor and that capacitor, wind the coil on a piece of PVC pipe, and the capacitor could be made out of a couple of sheets of tinfoil with wax paper in between, if you know what I mean, if you want to really homebrew it or buy a real transmitting grade capacitor. But to build the L network that makes the impedance step up from 2,000 to 2,000 ohms from 50, very easy. When you're feeding the outer edge of a 2,000 ohm antenna, because you're feeding the outer edge, one simple grounding rod at the bottom of the antenna would be more than enough counterpoise.